Blog Talk Radio.
An old Cherokee is teaching his grandson about life. He tells the grandson, "There's a fight that's going on inside me, and this is a terrible fight. You see, this fight is between two wolves. One wolf is evil. It is anger, envy, sorrow, full of regret, greed, arrogance, self-pity, guilt, resentment, inferiority, lies, false pride, superiority, and ego. The other wolf, though, this wolf is good. Joy, peace, love, full of hope, serenity, humility, kindness, benevolence, empathy, generosity, truth, compassion, and faith. Now, this same fight," he continues telling the grandson, "this same fight is going on inside you and inside every other person, too." The grandson, he thought about it for a minute and looked up, asked his grandfather, "Which wolf wins?" The old Cherokee simply replied, "It's the wolf you feed."
Yeah.
Lord, it's so hard living this life, a constant struggle each and every day. Some wonder why I'd rather die than to continue living this way. Many are blind and cannot find the truth, 'cause no one seems to really know. But I won't accept that this is how it's gonna be. Therefore, you got to let me and my people go. 'Cause I wanna be free, completely free. Lord, won't you please come and save me?
Wake up, goddammit!
Good evening, good afternoon, or good morning. It all just depends on what part of the world you are listening. Bienvenidos, que tal? Namaste, oki, and welcome, welcome, welcome to another episode of the Greenhouse Effects Radio Show. It's Wednesday, April 6th. My name is Will Green, holding down one half of our hosting duties on our live shows Mondays and Wednesdays. Holding down the other half of our host and duty, some call him the Lion's Historian, others call him Unc, some people call some other stuff too, we're not going to say, but I just simply call him my best friend. He's my dad, Bill Green. What's happening, Daddy-O? Good evening.
Hey, what's up, Wilfredo?
que pasa, que tell. I don't know what you be saying. Stop right there. What's up?
Bienvenidos is like welcome, and que tell is like what's up. You know, it's like they kind of go together. Yeah.
All right. Yeah. All right. Cool. Yes. Que tell. Anyway. Yeah, man, I hope your sinuses calm down enough and your throat doesn't drip too heavily, you know.
Yeah.
Keep that golden throat of yours from, you know, spitting out these words that flow so easily from your mouth. I'm empathizing with you, man, if you're under sinus attack. I mean, since you're under sinus attack, you know, and I know that all too well. I've been dealing with that for over 40 years, you know, so I know, man. Well, over 35.
I was out this morning in the rain, and so I think maybe it's just catching up to me, but before the show, I took a nice warm shower, so we'll see how it goes.
Oh, well, that definitely got it stirred up. But anyway, so I'm going to get out the way to let you go ahead and let those silvery words just flow so smoothly out of your mouth, man.
All right. Hope I don't have to. Anyway, so, ladies and gentlemen, at the beginning of every show, Dad and I always like to remind you, the listeners, of a couple of things. The first thing is we want to make sure that you grab a pencil and pad, a pen and paper, a post-it note, a marker, the back of an envelope or a napkin, something to write with in case you have any questions, any comments. We don't want you to forget anything. Maybe there's something you might want to share with us and with the listening audience. So we want to make sure you've got something to write with. We also have different ways for you to engage with us. Of course, if you want to share your questions or comments, there's a bunch of ways you can do it. Of course, you can always communicate with us on Facebook through the Facebook event page that we always set up, which I'm sure most of you get invitations. But another way you can engage with us, unlike other podcasts, you could two options. You can call in. Our number directly is area code 516-453-6094. I'll say it again because I'm sure you have something to write with now. It's 516-453-6094. And if you want to chime in with Dad and I, or again, ask those questions or that comment you wrote down, just press the 1 button on your keypad. That'll put your number in our queue, and we'll bring you in as soon as we can here on the Greenhouse Effects Radio Show. You know, 1,000 words will do. That's all I got to say. I made it short this time. But another way you can engage with us, in case you don't want to call, we can understand some of you may be hesitant to call in. We get it. So there's a chat room that's available on our live shows through the Blog Talk Radio site, blogtalkradio.com/thegreenhouseeffect. That's Greenhouse FX, the letter F, the letter X, all together. And you set up a free Blog Talk Radio profile that doesn't cost you anything. And you can access our chat room and communicate with us that way as well. It's actually more than likely a lot of your comments and chats will be shared before we bring you on the air. No, but I'm just kidding. But you have those different ways of communicating with us. So we always like to know what's on your mind. You know, what do you want to share? So please feel free to give us a call or comment in the chat from there. Dad and I, that's becoming very caller friendly, you know, and so up there he is. I hope I didn't speak too soon. But I guess we'll find out one day. Yeah, so let us know what's on your mind. That's our announcement. And again, our shows are archived and saved on multiple listening platforms as well. You can always go back and listen to our previous shows.
Right on.
So
that's right.
So we need to remind people about the save shows.
I was just going to say we need to do that more often and advertise a particular time and day that people can access the previous show. But, you know, glad that you mentioned it, because I should have been mentioning it myself. You know, because a lot of times folks just can't get to the shows, and it's nice to know that we have them archived, because people don't even know that, man. You know, it doesn't matter that it's been said before. Folks don't know that the shows are automatically archived, you know. And, of course, I don't know about you, but I just assume everybody would know that. But I don't know why. You're the one who told me.
Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, and they're available anytime, really, you know, anytime you want to take a listen to a show.
Right.
Just close your eyes and pick one.
Hundreds of platforms, right?
Yeah, we got a lot of more. Well, maybe not hundreds, but for the millions and millions of our fans out there, it's you know, quite a handful of selections. I know people listen to, you know, Apple Podcasts, we on there. Google Podcasts, we on there. Spotify, we on there. Even Mixcloud, some people listen to their favorite DJs. We on there too. And then, of course, it's their Blog Talk Radio.
I just said Anchor.
Anchor, yep. And, of course,
anyway,
Blog Talk Radio right here. So, you know, we're here, you know. Just a quick shout out to Adam, because I know Adam, sometimes if he missed the show, he jumps on. No, he already said it. Yeah, right on. Thank you, Adam. I didn't even know you put that in the chat room. Yeah, Adam follows us on Spotify, so he always checks us out on Spotify, which is cool. So, yeah, thank you.
I didn't know that. Dang, all them comments I've made about him thinking that he didn't check out the archive shows. I'm sorry, Adam. All right, let me get into the flow of where we're trying to go here. All right, man. So we good?
Yeah. We're good. Uh-huh. Things are well, not too quiet. I was going to say relatively quiet the last couple of days.
No. Nothing been quiet, man. You know, maybe you've been quiet, and maybe you've been hiding out, but it ain't hardly been quiet out here, man.
Yeah,
you know, by
yeah.
no stretch of the imagination, this stuff is coming at us left and right, and you know, and I'm saying us, and just as easily, stuff is coming at them left and right. Whoever us and them are, no one has been being excluded. I mean, it's deep. I mean, like today, where do we want to start? You know, there's still some fallout and residue, and will be for a while regarding the slap, you know, in Hollywood. As well as it should be, because I think that's a process that folks need to really articulate and deal with. I mean, it's something to see the things that are coming out even now, you know, that, you know, I think it's going to continue to spill out, because I think it's about time that, you know, the covers of Hollywood be pulled back a little bit, you know, and people start taking their fantasies seriously and realize that, you know, we can only pretend for so long before, you know, the shadow of reality is going to remind us, hey, you know, life is a serious business, and the serious needs to come first before the pretend. And all the pretend does is hide denial anyway, you know. And, of course, you can't out-deny people in denial. And all denial is the inability, inability or refusal to accept the obvious. You know, and you can't do anything about that, you know, and Hollywood has been a stronghold of denial, and of course able to hide behind it, because the veil of pretending is what we pay money to be a part of. I don't care if it's Hollywood or the women of Atlanta. I don't know the name of all these shows, the Jersey Shores, you know, all these things, you know, they call it, what they call it, reality shows, you know. You know, and it's like it's amazing how much people would rather invest in pretend than reality, but then you pretend as if it is reality and start talking that cliche kind of commentary, you know, that so many hide behind, you know. And it sounds like positive speaking, it sounds like positivity, it sounds like positive reinforcement, but it's canned commentary to avoid having to be real, and tell people how you really feel, how you really think, how you really behave. You know, let's use the cliches, because every, you know, people are so much more comfortable pretending than the truth. Now, I just before we started tonight, you know, I got my monitor on and something caught my eye, you know, but this isn't about pretending. This is about reality. You know, you have the Senator, what's her name? Marsha Blackburn out of Tennessee. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I don't know if you're up on her smear tactics, but, you know, those that have been coming from her party anyway, you know, that pretty much have been slamming Democrats and in many ways poke the same issues at Ketanji Brown Jackson about being pro-pedophile. Remember we talked about Shadow Man, you know, how, you know, you can only go so far before it's going to bring you back to your truth. Well, Tennessee just passed a law, you know, lowering the age of marriage to 12, you know, and it's on the heels of this dude who was, you know, sent to prison for his pedophilic behavior that they're arguing, Tucker Carlson and this other dude, are arguing on live television. You know, Tucker Carlson is taking this dude's position that, well, he wasn't really a pedophile. You know, he really, you know, didn't do, you know, anything to harm this 12-year-old girl. And the other dude is saying, yeah, he raped her, you know, and that's a federal offense. Well, are you sure that that's what it is? You know, and people listen to this, and they hear it, and they're going to side with a dude like Tucker Carlson because they depend on his lies to help strengthen their denials. You know, and these folks hear this every night, five nights a week, and that's all they digest, and it becomes their reality. MSNBC, on the other hand, will come on and speak from its perspective, but they're speaking to the same kind of audience who pretty much is like already on page with them about what they're saying. So it's like, you know, you don't have to keep reminding me about these things that come out of Fox. What you have to understand is that you need to figure out a campaign to be able to reach the people who watch Fox, because you're just singing to the choir just like Fox is. So here we are. We have this incredible dichotomy going on in Congress. And this incredible dichotomy allows people to say some of the most aggravating for me, aggravating things that that one could imagine. But nevertheless, you know, it's the game we're playing today in America. I'm sorry, what, Will?
Oh, I'm sorry. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you. I just didn't understand what you said.
No, dang. My mic is supposed to be muted. I'm sorry. I was actually testing it at the same time. But anyway, we'll talk about that later. No, they say these things, and I'm like, man, how come you can't arrest these people for, like, defamation of character? I mean, like, they say these things, and it just makes me mad, man. It just pisses me off sometimes. Like, how can these people say these things and be okay with saying these things and, you know, saying things about people? And I'm sorry. I had a moment thinking about these things that were said recently about Ketanji Brown, but I know you're not there yet. But I just had a moment. Sorry.
Well, it's not a moment. It's the first right, and it's the First Amendment. It's freedom of speech. So, you know, and freedom of speech as outlined is so much broader, but nevertheless, that's the crux of it, whether that speech comes from a political arena or a religious one. And, of course, it has its stipulations and it has its, you know, boundaries. And the freedom of speech only extends so far, you know, as to, you know, prevent the type of talk that would be threatening. Well, anyway, yeah, it would be a matter of us having to read the First Amendment to really get into the dynamics of what it is really saying in regards to freedom of speech. And, you know, the beauty about the Constitution is that it has built within it the ability to adapt and adjust itself according to whatever the current events are for any given society at any given time. So if you look at First Amendment, Second Amendment, Third Amendment, think about, you know, the 1700s when it was first developed, and you have to take into consideration what the attitude of the, what I call the oligarchy of the founding fathers, you know, that 6% of rich white men that were, in fact, writing out a parchment that would lay the foundation for the belief structures of generations to come, you know, lawfully. You know, so, but it's a matter of understanding then what was the attitude, what was it like 300 years ago to be on the East Coast within the limited perspective of the future and seeing it from 13 colonies and not even imagining the distance between the Atlantic to the Pacific, Canada to Mexico, and all of the inhabitants in between, but creating democracy for the select few. So there's a certain element in American culture that is able to benefit from, you know, that that philosophy of the select few. And you can, you know, we have all kind of colorful names for them, you know, whether they be white supremacists or whether they be Black Panthers. You know, we have, you know, these concepts that really, if America ever wanted to own its own denial, it would eventually just have to admit that we don't know how to talk about race, we don't know how to talk about color, and we sure don't know how to talk about rights being equal. You know, we have a very come see, come saw approach toward the rights of those who aren't among the select citizens that dictate social policy. You know, we have instead two very dichotomously opposing frames of those who dictate policy and those who react to policy. And those who react to policy, based on how America has played this game for the past 300 years, is never allowed to compete with any element of fairness in our society. So we get used to the field being slanted. You know, we get used to the dynamics of inequality. We get used to the crumbs of food that falls from the table. And we get used to crawling around on the rug eating the crumbs rather than feeling that we have a rightful place at the banquet table. We get used to that. We've been conditioned for that for all the years that this government has developed. So freedom of speech, as it was designed, really wasn't meant to include people who don't agree with the principles of the founding oligarchy. So white supremacy has always been a part of American society, whether America once admitted it or not. It started that way. You know, you can't take a human being and carve that human being up in slavery and look at that human being and reduce that human being to three-fifths of a human, unless you are one who entertains and believes in the idea of white supremacy. So everything that we're dealing with today is born from that very thing, from what we call the founding fathers, or what they call the founding fathers. And taking pride in being able to say it like that as if these were magicians who really somehow transcended their own natural attitudes and beliefs and really took on this incredibly Christian, for lack of a better word, attitude about all, even though they say all men, we have to use our imagination and assume they really meant all men and all women, you know, are equal. But we don't have to worry about calling those others men, you know, because they're only three-fifths of a man. And those who come along with them, therefore, only get to share three-fifths of their reality as well. And Indians and the rest of them, well, they all fit into the same brand of non-white. That's the attitude that this country and its constitution was founded on. And it's grown and it's evolved to deal with the changing times, but it's never, ever, you know, allowed itself to truly treat all of its constituents as equal. We, meaning black people, are still fighting for civil rights promised to us 160 years ago. We're still fighting for voting rights promised to us 160 years ago. You know, we're still fighting for the right to just move around in this country, you know, which was promised to us when the Fair Housing Act was passed. You know, yeah, I can move around in this country, but I better be aware of where I'm talking about moving. You know, and it's the element that has continued, you know, to fuel the flame. And that's what was so hard about the slap, you know. And that was what's been so hard about Ketanji Jackson, Brown Jackson's hearings, you know. And but it's what's been so hard about, you know, being a black man in America for 75 years anyway. You know, I mean, if I had a big, like a being black dartboard, you know, and it had a silhouette of America on it, you know, but the theme was being black in America. And if I had that kind of dartboard, I could just take the dart and it would be sectioned into years. And wherever it hits, you know, it doesn't matter what year it hits. Yeah, you know, that has affected me in my lifetime. Yeah, and it doesn't matter if it's the 18th century, you know, the 1700s. Born from slavery, the issues that black folks are still dealing with today, you know. And what's amazing about all this is how thoroughly it's been buried in history, you know, how absolutely unbelievably effective, you know, what is it that we say? Until lions have historians, right? Hunters mm-hmm. will always be heroes, you know, and this is a land, you know, founded by hunters, you know, and, you know, we're the lions ducking for cover, man. You know, yeah. Anybody who doesn't fit into that 6% profile. And you know what's something that Sarah Palin just said. You know, I mean, nope. You remember her?
Oh, boy.
It just said today. I mean, just said it because she's running for a vacant congressional seat in Alaska. You
okay.
know, and she's a shoo-in because she has Trump's endorsement. What a team that would be. Maybe they're already plotting to run in 2024. They're guaranteed to win if they do. Yeah, what were those two called? Those two dudes called Beavis and Butthead? And what was their movie? Dumb and Dumber or something like that? I mean, you know, what a perfect pair. But anyway, she said, you know, how insulted she is by President Biden's commitment to select a black woman for the Supreme Court of the United States position, and quoted as saying, it's pretty insulting that he decided to just create those parameters because there are so many good, qualified constitutionals out there. I have no idea what that statement means beyond the fact that she doesn't like that he decided in his campaign to have a black female in the Supreme Court. How dare him? But this is coming out of the mouth of somebody who was selected to run with, what was my man's name? Who ran against Obama. Man, I'm looking at him and all of a sudden I can't remember his name. And obviously you can't remember his name either. The John McCain, you know, selected to be his running mate because of the hope that her as vice president would stir the popularity of the people to be equal to that as Obama as president was stirring the people. And they called it star status. And they called Obama a rock star and how he was having these folks respond to his ability to speak, his ability to stir imagination, his ability to lift people up in the idea of hope springs eternal. And they needed somebody to capture the right audience, the right wing audience, with the same verve and tenacity. So that after careful choosing, they came up with her, you know. And somehow, which wound up destroying McCain's campaign, by the way, because she actually felt that she was more valuable than he was to his presidency. She destroyed it literally because of her idiocy. And this idiot feels like she has the right to say President Biden had no business making a commitment to put a black woman on the Supreme Court, and then the one that he chose, how dare him say she was the most qualified of the constitutionals. Now, I don't know about you, but I, over the years, have learned enough about Sarah Palin to know that that word constitutionals wasn't one that she came up with. You know, and if you asked her what that really meant, well, that would be the end of the conversation as you know it. But it's just amazing that, you know, these folks can throw this stuff out here and there's more than enough people to say, yeah, you know. And I'm not taking away from what you're saying. It is enough to make you want to slap somebody, you know, what I call make you want to do a Will Smith. I need to stop. No, I ain't going to stop. I didn't want to do a Will Smith or somebody. And then cuss him out after I'm done.
Getting jiggy with
him. You know, let's go all the way with this. So, I don't know, man. What? Any comments, any thoughts, what you got, man? Because I'm pretty sure I'm just getting on everybody's
head. Holy cow. I mean, where do I begin? Going back a little bit to, I didn't know about that Tennessee thing, first of all. I'm going to have to check that out.
Yeah.
Read up on that.
Yeah.
That's, you know. Anyway, that's.
Yeah. Yeah. It's deep.
It's deep.
And, you know, of course, my temptation is to start with all the stereotypes, but I'm not going to do it.
No, you're not going to do that. But just thinking back to what you were saying, the shadow going all the way back, dealing with shadow and the shadows of reality, and pretending. You know, I was just doing some meditating earlier, thinking about the show, and I think not in this show, but I definitely want to remind our listening audience, as I've done in the past, that I think this is a good time. As you know, the seasons are changing. We talk about spring cleaning the house. It's a good time for spring cleaning, you know, ourselves and our energy. And, you know, we're dealing with this issue in Hollywood, and we're still dealing with issues of COVID, and we're still hoping that things are back to normal, putting up the quotes, but, you know, things aren't normal, and we're dealing with so many, you know, mental health issues and stuff like that. So I think that, you know, this need to pretend, this need to watch reality shows, this need for instant gratification even, has grown and evolved itself into this other thing where, you know, the lies and are becoming reality, like you said. Well, what's that we say? We keep believing the lies, we keep telling the lies, and eventually those lies become the truth. And I think that's where a lot of us are. We've forgotten that, you know, a lot of this stuff is just pretend. You know, it's just an actor. It's just a film. It's just a movie or series, that this isn't real life. You know, social media is not really real, you know, but I think in all these efforts to escape, you know, I think it's just added on to some of the general issues that, you know, we as a majority of people have been dealing with. So I'm saying all that just to say that it's so much to unravel, I think, in looking at our mental and even spiritual health, that like I said, and maybe later on in a show before the end of the month, you know, we can definitely, you know, remind people and talk about, exercises, if you will, for mental health and stuff like that. You know, we haven't talked about that in a while too. So I just wanted to kind of unravel some of that because there was so much that you were hitting that spoke to me as far as just things we need to do to make sure that, again, mentally and spiritually and physically, that we take care of each other, of ourselves.
Well, the theme of mental health, that's always something that can be talked about for sure, but it's a very difficult thing to define, more or less understand. You know, it's a very elusive, very broad, and very confusing topic to start to unravel. And if you don't believe me, just take a look at the DSM, or the Diagnostics and Statistics Manual, you know, written by psychiatrists for psychiatrists in the World Health, through the organization of the World Health, or what we call WHO, the World Health Organization, WHO. And the DSM's like in its fifth revised writing, and it's a big book. And even in its own history, it has overwritten and redefined the diagnostics used to determine various levels of mental disorders. So, yeah, we could, you know, most people don't have an understanding of this, however, from a psychiatric point of view. So what we would wind up doing is just talking about good intentions, you know, what we would consider to be good, healthy living and believing. You know, but again, the problem with talking about something in a way that supposedly would outline a healthy way of being is to have to consider what is a healthy way of being and how well am I subscribing to that? You know, what's one person's pain is another person's joy. So the question to me, not so much the answer, and the question to me is, what does a person feel is a good, healthy attitude toward life? Some right there in itself would be a healthy debate in trying to define a good, healthy attitude toward life. It's not necessarily unhealthy to get angry. You know, although he's not quoted often, if ever, for saying it, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. once said, well, I read that he said, like when we ever read quotes, you know, unless we were really privy to be in all these audiences that all these great, you know, motivational speakers spoke from, you know, he said that anger toward injustice has done more to bring about social change than love for justice. Still see that, you know, as being applicable to today. So it's a matter of really having a courtship almost, you know, with it, like in our case, listeners who might tune into the show, you know, and even with ourselves, you know, to really see or try to figure out, you know, if there's any hypocrisy in what we're talking about. And for that matter, if there's elements of healthy well-being that we struggle with every day, you know, it's, you know, a person who commits suicide is not a one-dimensional individual, as I'm sure we all would, hopefully we all believe. So it's just a matter of where our focus is today. Like, is it on teenagers? Is it on black male teenagers? Is it on females? Is it on the victims of bullying? You know, is it, you know, and this is just from the younger crowd. People, I think, assume that the older you get, the less peer pressure has an influence on behavior. Now, peer pressure, if anything, gets more intense the older we get. But by no means does it, dissipate. It's just sometimes as adults we don't recognize it as peer pressure. You know, we just think it's people getting on our nerves. Anyway, so like one of my ex-wives would say, "You're just worrying my nerves." So I remember, one of my marriages, I'm a guy who likes to talk about feelings, but that doesn't mean I'm the most balanced when I'm talking about them, right? But I was married to somebody who absolutely avoided at all costs talking about feelings. As a matter of fact, her philosophy was, why talk about them today when we can put them off to tomorrow? So it's like, so you want me to hold on to my anger for 3 days? I won't even remember it by then. And that's, of course, what the hope was. But the energy doesn't go away, as you mentioned. It just turns into shadow, So I would just be on my high horse, just, going like 40. And I could see in her eyes the shades just gradually going down. And I came to understand that she was thinking, sooner or later, this man is going to have to pause long enough to breathe. And when he does, I'm out of here. And rightfully so. I don't know where it was that I had decided I was the pontificator or the aware and enlightened one who could speak from a platform of righteous, healthy dialogue, with someone who was a total stranger to me before I asked her to marry me. So it's like, never thought about talking about how well do you express your feelings any more than she ever thought about how well you keep your feelings to yourself. So it's a matter of understanding in dialogue, what's healthy and what isn't. And I think herein lies the crux or the rub, as you like to say. If we haven't had a healthy dialogue about, the balance of the mental, the medical, the psychological and the emotional well-being of us and our truths, then chances are we're going to have a rough go when it comes to expressing how we feel. And all too often, I think that's what brings most marriages or most committed relationships to a staggering halt. People run out of words to say that shield the words that are never said. And again, pretending or trying to, as much as possible, stay in an audition state in a relationship instead of recognizing, the evolutionary process of a relationship may not result in a positive outcome. Sometimes when people stay with each other long enough, they find out, I don't know who you are today, but you ain't who I married. Yeah, I am. But it's just that as we gotten older, we haven't adapted to each other. And I think that's because we haven't grown in language. We haven't grown in dialogue. We haven't grown in confrontation. We haven't grown in the ability to express true feelings and intended not to be hurtful. The great issue that most people have is a failure to develop a tiebreaker. And so in a situation of argument, who in the hell is right when both start out feeling that way? Well, if we don't have a tiebreaker, you're not right just because I shut up, and I'm not right just because I shut you up. We still are left with our own, polarized attitudes about, no, he's wrong, or no, she's wrong. No, I'm right. I may not be right, but I ain't wrong. I'm retired now, but I was a counselor for over 40 years, and it was amazing to me as a counselor, not as a human being, but as a counselor, it was amazing to me, that the idea of two people sitting down in a safe environment, hopefully, with a referee called a counselor, and saying how they feel without attacking was so difficult to do. Almost every argument, discussion, or issue was based on the unresolved question, you know, and neither had within the capacity of themselves to even know how to ask the question, more or less try to figure out the answer. You know, dialogue, either the lost art of listening, you know, the thing about listening, it doesn't require two people because then nobody would talk. Listening is a shared event, and it doesn't have to be equal. Some people can express their feelings in a more thorough way than others, so it becomes a matter of, you know, checks and balances. Okay, you're talking too much. Okay, you're not talking enough. You know, and it's like, okay, how can we even the playing field? Well, herein lies the rub. So I don't even know how I got on this track, man. This is a long way from what I told you I was going to get tonight.
Yeah, that was that's my fault, man. I put the mental health and spring cleaning and all that stuff cables on you and got you charged up on that. That's all. That's where that came from. Just dealing with the changes. I would say just as we deal with these changes or these challenges or whatever it is that we want to call it in this society today, you know, and just, I mean, you know, 4 years of Trump, right? Lack of this and people getting killed, you know, killed by police and, these, you know, all these different things that have continued to pile up, and but a lot of us just have had to just deal with it and not really had any ways to work on it.
Yeah. Amen.
So, you know, and that's where I was just coming from with the whole thing with the shadows of pretending and how we get so caught up in the glamour of these reality shows and these movies, because you know, people know me. I love my movies, man. And, you know, I have fun with it, you know, and I can definitely understand, how I can understand how easy it is to get caught up in that.
Yeah.
You know,
absolutely.
But,
heck yeah, man. Absolutely. Look here, I'm a romantic, but I'm a romantic without a, you know, without a partner, without a honey. That's why I can't say partner right now like we used to be able to. You know, without a girlfriend, or, you know, I can't say girl, without
a lady friend.
A female counterpart, a lady, you know, but that sounds so chauvinistic. Anyway,
yeah.
not having that significant other, I don't know. Anyway, you know, so I have to I have to satisfy my romantic hunger, you know, by going through the index and find the movies that, you know, that provide that reassurance, pretending takes on, you know, many different dynamics, man. And you know, sometimes, you know, the pretending is a heck of a lot more comfortable than reality. But it's hard for most of us to admit that.
Heck
you know,
yeah.
So, you know, after a while, though, it becomes an imbalance. And when it becomes out of sorts, then, you know, strange behaviors start arising. Suddenly, we start believing our fantasies, and we start looking for those to fill the bill, you know, only to find once we find them that, damn, the old arguments ain't gone nowhere.
As soon as they find them, they were like, you're not the person I thought you were, you know.
Old issues ain't gone nowhere. You know, but there's a Rumi quote that I love. You know, I love Rumi, you know, the poet. He says, what you're seeking is seeking you. And man, if that could become the motto of heart pursuits, I think a whole lot of us would be so much better off, because what we would have to do is, you know, identify what first I'm seeking, and then secondly, how I would know when it shows up, you know, because obviously it would have to be that identified desire based on my own individual want. You know, what you are seeking is seeking you. Yeah, so, you know, like, I might also say, maybe I don't want that. I don't, I'm looking for, you know, somebody rich because I'm broke, you know. So, you know, but, you know, I'm looking for that out of need. So then, you know, suddenly here somebody comes along that's my mirror, you know. And, you know, they're looking for somebody who is willing to be remade, you know, and they have the resources. And, yeah, I need me a man who doesn't have nothing, and I'll show him how to have everything. You know, and he's like, I need me a woman who has everything, you know, because I don't have nothing. You know, and then all of a sudden it becomes the issue of, you know, I'm not who you thought I was. And there it is, man. In the end, I'm not
who
you thought I was.
That Rumi quote always...
Rumi.
The Rumi quote. It hits me different ways sometimes. So like this time,
hearing it again,
you know, I realize it makes you like, well, at this instance, this time, you know, what you're seeking is seeking you. It's like, well, what the hell do I want? What am I seeing?
Yeah.
You know, it's like, let me stop for a minute. You know?
Yeah. And that takes a full needs assessment to determine
full
that.
Needs assessment.
You know, and it's, yeah, total full needs assessment and not the bailout effect, you know. Just come to my rescue. Well, okay, but you're going to find somebody who's looking for you to come to their rescue. You know, yeah, man, what you're seeking is seeking you. You know, I did want to, if it's okay, I wanted to just touch on one thing. It's totally removed from the major topics I've already just gave up on. So there was, well, if we have enough time left in the show topics. so what I, you know, where I thought, anyway, if you don't mind, I'd just like to just talk about Magic Johnson for a second. Magic Johnson hasn't spoken to Howard Stern since a racist 1998 interview, you know, on Magic's short-lived The Magic Hour show, you know, which I never heard of. You know, so I'm reading about this thinking, wait a minute, I never even knew he had a show in 1998. It was called The Magic Hour, you know, and in reading about it, he was explaining, not really explaining, it was just part of the interview about what happened on that show when he was interviewing Howard Stern and the reason why he even brought Howard Stern was even brought on the show. It wasn't, you know, we assume that the host is the one who actually brings the interviewees on the show. That's not always the case. But I was thinking, even while I was reading it, well, there must be a motive behind this, and I guess he has some kind of mini docuseries is coming out, and I'm assuming that in the docuseries it goes into the things of his life and the things he's encountered along the way. But anyway, this interview, he commented, so many times I wanted to say something and hit him at the same time on air. He's talking about while he was interviewing Howard Stern. And I thought, wow, okay, that's kind of deep. So many times I wanted to say something and hit him at the same time on air, you know. And he said that he was mad when they booked him, meaning Howard Stern, but there was nothing you can do when people look for ratings. You know, here's the irony of that. You know, I was mad when they booked him, but there's nothing you can do when people look for ratings. So He said, this is what happens. Now, Magic only hosted 12 episodes, but the show that brought Howard Stern on was because Howard Stern was just, you know, he was really just berating Magic Johnson, I guess talking about his show, talking about his skills, and whatever the case may be as far as his ability to interview people. So, you know, they brought him on the show. Magic didn't want him on the show. He was still smarting from all the comments Stern was making about him. And so when he finally had him on the show, sat him down, you know, things calmed down. You know, and you can see this on, I think, YouTube or whatever. It's really a spooky thing to watch because of how the show even started. I don't know what Howard Stern was doing, but it looked like he had a couple dudes on their knees who were farting into a loudspeaker. Anyway, it's crazy. Magic said, let's get right to it. Why have you been talking about me so much, man? And Howard Stern didn't lose a beat. He told Magic to stop trying to talk like the white man. He said, excuse me for laughing, but I can't help but to, you know, because I'm imagining Magic, you know, like 20 plus years ago, you know, early retired, dealing with HIV and a host of other issues, and having these issues with Stern anyway, and then having this cat in his opening sentence say, you know, stop trying to talk like the white man. Everybody's anti-Ebonics these days. And I say, let it fly, man. You know, what you need to do, my brother, is to really get down with it. You know, and
my brother?
Yeah,
he said that?
This is what Howard Stern said. Yeah, I'm watching the thing, man. And, you know, I didn't get all the way through it because I gotta get my breath back to watch the last half. But what I saw up until then, now you said, my brother, is to get down with it. You know, and you can see on Magic Johnson's face, you know, that pie in the face, stupid look we get when we try to grin our way through it, you know. And then Howard Stern went on, and I'm just going to stop right after this next sentence. He said, I grew up in a black neighborhood, so you know what's coming next. And believe me, I'm blacker than you are.
Yeah. Oh, my God.
And then it was a lot. Oh, yeah. And then it just went worse. It went downhill from that point, you know. And so Magic had to sit there and take it, you know, totally disrobed, totally. And the only grip he had was to say, they brought this dude on, and I had nothing to say about it for the ratings. Painful could that have been? Man. But at the same time, you know, there are people who would watch it and say, yeah, you had it coming, you know, because Howard Stern is the shock jock. You know, you should have known that he wasn't going to approach you with you know, an equal playing field. You should have known he was going to be as much as this. He had you at a disadvantage because he's allowed to be Howard Stern. You know, you're only allowed to be Magic on the basketball court, dude. You at my neighborhood when you want to start talking to people. Yeah. So, you know, anyway, I just wanted to just, you know, again, so much has spilled out from the Will Smith, Chris Rock, Jada Pinkett Smith encounter that I don't know if there's enough days in the year, you know, enough weeks in the month, you know, to ever really be able to get all of what these three experience in this one moment that is so reflective of their lives for all the times up to that moment. Because we're not dealing with a spontaneous situation that was born from normalcy. We're talking about, you know, a reality born from a reality show called Hollywood that never revealed, you know, what pretending had hidden. Yeah, and I don't know for black folks if that can ever be talked about enough. It's just too bad that it was uncovered, you know, in the front of such a huge white audience. So it's like now we have to face the truth of our pretending, you know, and why we pretend when we do pretend, whether you're the ones on the stage or whether you're the ones in the audience or whether you're the ones like me sitting at home just watching the whole thing. You know, because it definitely touched me beyond that one moment. Yeah, so
and then I still think I still think that there's another part of that pretending, that other layer of pretending. This guy can come on magic, you know.
Yeah.
Why are you talking white? You know, why are you pretending? You know?
Yeah.
But you know, all everybody non-white that's acting, you know, I'm not even just going to say black people, but in the end, when it comes to Hollywood, we still got to pretend and be like white America. That's Hollywood, La La Land, you know?
Yeah.
So, I mean, what is those other layers of pretending
exactly.
to be pretending, you know, that...
Exactly, yeah.
You know, I mean, there's just some changes. I mean, that's the, you know, with people opening up their own studios now and not depending on Hollywood to make movies, you know. You know, I know how much we don't really get at the Tyler Perry movies, you know, but at least he's got his own studio, you know. I'm not going to get into that. But anyway, the whole point is it's just
we
the layers.
We can, just not tonight. All right, it's already
in class. Just the layers of pretending and all those other layers that people don't talk about, especially for people of color who are trying to navigate through Hollywood, you know. But you're black.
Yeah.
Why are you talking like that? Why are you acting like that? You know.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Why are you trying to sound white? Yeah. Yeah, man. I see your boys in the queue,
brother.
Man. You want to bring them in for a couple minutes?
Yeah, yeah. Ladies and gentlemen, like I said again, in the beginning of the show, and I'm sorry that we don't remind you ahead of, throughout the show, but as you can see, Dad and I just kind of just start dialoguing and talking. But again, we have ways that you can engage with us, and our phone lines are always open. You don't have to wait for us to say, the phone lines are now open, ladies and gentlemen. All you have to do is just call in. Our phone lines are open. You don't have to wait for that. No bells or nothing like that. So just give us a call. Your number's in the queue. Like Adam. Adam, our longtime supporter, listener, primo. You know, always love to bring him in and see what's on his mind. So, you know, ladies and gentlemen, give us a call and let us know what's on your mind as well. So with that, what's up, Adam? How you doing tonight, cuzzo?
Long time. Good. Long time listener, first time caller. How you guys doing tonight?
Stop lying to the people now. Yeah, stop lying to the people. Why are you going to do that? I just gave that nice introduction. You pull that crap.
Bill, I had a question about something you were talking about earlier in regards to being a counselor.
Uh-huh.
Did you guys have people that you could talk to after counseling sessions? Because, I mean, you guys are taking all of that in. How do you – what was your release?
Great question.
Well, you have to take into account that counseling was not a singular art that was developed at one time, and that's how it remained. Counseling evolved, and as it evolved, certain aspects of it evolved with it. So when I first started out as a counselor, it wasn't a specialty. You know, it was more of an eclectic kind of approach where no one thing, no one approach, no one method was required. And the credentials were not in high demand. So actually, the sicker I was, the better qualified I was to be a counselor. So that's why the field, when I first got into it, was inundated with recovering alcoholics. And the theme of AA was pretty much the prevalent approach toward non-medical treatment. You know, when it became medical treatment, then, of course, you had to deal with the medical field, which had to do with the detox process. And that was pretty much at the time why people would be in treatment. So as they stabilized, then counseling, talk therapy, become a part of it. I'm just giving you that little background to understand. So me as a recovering alcoholic, I was required to attend my meetings. I was required to have a sponsor. I was required to, well, not required, but if possible, have a home group so that I had, my wagons were circled, and the only thing I had to be concerned about was the rifles pointed out or in. So,
yep.
You know, so I was pretty well covered, and that's how, you know, I evolved. However, the field began to shift, and credentials became paramount. They became the same, and that meant, you know, people had to. It wasn't that people had to be degreed. Like in Illinois, you still don't have to be degreed to be a counselor. And some states are like that, but in states like Texas, you do have to be degreed. So it's a matter of what each state is requiring, you know, for a license. So as my field in Illinois began to evolve, where the demands for credentials became the theme of the day, you have to understand that the field of counseling, substance abuse counseling, went through its own evolution, where in the social working field, there were a lot of people who had bachelor degrees in the field of science, behavioral science, and that field just kind of collapsed. So you had all these folks looking for jobs, and they were willing to accept entry-level jobs, which were my job, you know, just to be able to maintain themselves. So you got the choice. You're going to take somebody degree or an ex-drunk. Chances are you're going to take the person degree, because marketing also became a part of the ever-evolving field, where you market your programs. You even see that on TV today, where some hospitals or some treatment facilities will talk about their high rate of success. Well, when they talk about the high rate of success, they're talking about the people who leave their programs clean and sober. So you better have a high rate of success. You know, as you say it, yeah, well, 70% of our people leave drunk or high. Well, that's not a very good program. So, you know, you say 95% of our people leave out, you know, stable. That means 5% don't. But anyway, who argues that, you know? So what happened as the field became more and more evolved toward the degreed individuals, there was an element that degreed individuals didn't bring with them. They did not bring a support system. You know, so the field began to recognize that, you know, a lot of our counselors are attacking our clients. What's the problem? Well, you know, there's a lot of problems there, but the main one was that how dare you, client, you know, not trust me. You know, I have a nameplate. Yeah, I have initials behind my name. I'm a professional. And, you know, the client was like, all right, man, just tell me what bullshit you want me to say. And then you go ahead and just put that in your chart, and you can go ahead and treatment plan my bullshit. You know, and so, you know, like, yeah, this was the war that started unfolding, man. And then there was the element of shift in most treatment programs began to have this influx of cocaine abusers. Now, you know, a cocaine abuser is just the opposite of an alcoholic. An alcoholic winds up in treatment because, you know, over the years he or she has just lost everything. So they come in there in their 30s, you know, and they're like, their lives are done. You know, a cocaine abuser, man, you know, and I'm saying abuser because forget about addict. You know, a cocaine abuser comes into treatment, you know, because the job said if you don't go, you're going to lose it, or, you know, things like that. So they wind up in treatment mainly because they got to keep their job, because they got to keep their money, because they're going to have to deal with paying for their, you know, their habit over the weekend. You know,
the only way they could keep their job and keep doing their job is the cocaine.
And so they got to pay for that. And the only way they can pay for it is by doing what the job says. So they show up in treatment. Now, our programs are used to people coming in humble, beat down, you know, got nowhere else to go. You know, shucks. And these folks, men and women, they come in fired up. And plus, cocaine is a stimulant anyway, and alcohol is a depressant. So, and now they ain't on their coke, and they jacked, man. They're like, what do you mean, shut up? What do you mean? You know, I don't have nothing to say yet. What do you mean I don't know what I'm talking about? You know, what makes you an expert on? They challenged everything. They're like constantly just like, what are we going to do? Because you know, we gotta have people to fill the beds. That's the only way we can be funded. So a lot of these folks, you know, the treatment facilities began to do this thing, and I don't remember what it was called, but it was like it was kind of this inbred thing where they had what they called supervision. And supervision was for the clients of a program. And the supervisor, whoever the clinical supervisor was, scheduled 1 hour a week for counselors to come in and talk about themselves. However they wanted to spend that hour, it was dedicated to them. If they wanted to talk about the issues of the job, if they wanted to talk about clashes with other workers, they wanted to talk about the struggles they were having at home, it was up to them to identify for that hour what they were going to spend talking about with their supervisor. And the idea was just what you're asking, that in doing that, it would help give them that outlet to relieve some of the pressures of dealing with these assholes. Yeah, it wasn't that usual to hear, you know, in a staff meeting, you know, a clinician just all of a sudden say, you know, that asshole. And everybody's like, what? Well, the thing that I learned early on in treatment, that no matter how well you may think you are and how balanced, and no matter how dedicated one may feel, like myself, they are to the field, eventually that client from hell is going to show up. And when that client from hell is going to show up, believe me, by the end of the day, you're going to be questioning, if this is really what I want to do for the rest of my life. You know, and that's what supervision was designed to help us deal with, you know. So, the field eventually learned that, oh, no, we have to put something in our program that will give our clinicians that outlet at least once a week to be able to vent, be able to process, begin to explore. But it was never without accountability. So whatever it was, the supervisor's job was to find the kind of help you're identifying. You get me? So if I'm struggling with this client behavior, whatever it is, then the supervisor would come up with a plan that would require this clinician to go to whatever that type of self-help group may be, or whatever that kind of professional guidance may be, you know, or whatever that type of mentorship may be. But that was the way the field began to do it. But, of course, that eventually decayed, and I don't even know if they do supervision anymore, but because of all the compromises the mental health profession had to make with substance abuse treatment. But that was the idea back in the 80s. Jesus, you know, man, I can't believe I just said that, back in the 80s. You know, so I don't have any idea, you know, what treatment does for clinicians these days. I have a feeling that it's, you know, I got mine.
It's never enough.
Yours.
Yeah.
But I don't know. Yeah.
Wow.
So I'm sorry to take the long road to answer that question, but there's really no simple way to.
No.
Yeah.
Yeah, cool. That was a good question, though. Very good question.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
I don't know why I never thought of that.
Because you wouldn't, right? Why would you need to? You know, I mean, like, if you're not around it, if you haven't experienced it, if you haven't wandered into that kind of arena, there's no reason that you would have to ask, I wonder what this person's thinking right now as they hear me, you know, spin my yarn.
The person I'm pouring my heart out to, who do they have to go and talk to and just let it all go? Yeah.
Yeah, what makes them expert on me? Yeah, yeah.
It's almost like a reality show, because you can sit there and look at the reality show or watch the reality show and say, well, damn, at least I'm not that messed up. And I like watching this reality show because it lets me know that there are some people that are really, really jacked up, and at least I'm not there yet.
You know, see, treatment is the level playing field. You know, it's degrees of sick. But everybody, nobody works in the field of addiction unless they have identified issues with it. I don't care if you're a medical director. I don't care if you're the entry-level counselor. The law of attraction applies in any treatment setting. There's always going to be something in, now they may not be talking about it, but there's always going to be a something in a person's background that compelled them to enter into the field of the helping professions. Always. You know, something. You know, it's just a matter of, you know, disclosure. You know, who's going to really be willing to share their story. See, early on when I entered the field, it was perfect because we were mostly made up of recovering alcoholics. So every, you know, recovering alcoholic always wants to tell their story. As a matter of fact, real quick, I remember once when I was early on in the field and I was working as house manager, the graveyard shift, and I was working at a halfway house, co-ed halfway house. And Adele, I'm not going to say her last name, but Adele was a client that came to me because she couldn't sleep. It's like 1 o'clock in the morning. And, you know, I was still a counselor trainee. So right away I went to the high ground. You know, I was telling her my story. And about an hour and a half later, she looked at me and said, you know, that was an interesting story. And she said, but why are you telling me? And, you know, it's like, what do you mean, why am I telling you? You're supposed to feel so much better now. Like, you know, she sat there for that hour and a half, bored to tears. She came to talk, not to listen. That was one of my first humiliating experiences of shadow, you know, and the importance of not putting me before the client, you know. And I had a couple more before I finally caught on, you know. Two things I learned, you know. Clients lie, and my power rests in the pen. I get to write anything in their chart I want to, you know, and I can hide my feelings behind the pen, you know. The power of the pen and clients lie. Man, it became so much easier when I let clients be clients. You know, man. Anyway,
you were able to hide not your pain, but you were able to hide behind your pen.
My issues, if I had them. See, this is what I'm saying: is the power of the pen allows a counselor to write about a client whatever they want.
Okay.
And we can disguise it as being a treatment plan. And we can disguise the dynamics of client behavior as being consistent with what the plan is outlined. You know, nowhere in there does it require self-disclosure on my part, because the assumption is I'm the professional in the room. You know, so again, if I'm not getting my needs met, oh, you can believe that, you know, it's going to be an active playing field going on in the hour we spend together. You know, nobody knows who's who. It's an amazing field, man. You know, it can do
God,
so
God
much
bless
good.
You. Thank you.
Yeah, but
thank
it can
you
do
for
so
your
much
work.
Harm.
Thank you for your service.
Okay. You're welcome. I mean, there's a lot of folks who wouldn't agree with you. I tell you, though, I had a shining moment when I was working at a halfway house on the south side of Chicago, all male, black. And I never thought I would wind up with that job, and that's the job I prayed for. And Will's ma found me an apartment in Chicago. I was living in Waukegan at the time, and she found me an apartment that I moved into sight unseen. And it turned out to be in a neighborhood I always wanted to live in. You know, and this was, you know, long after we had been divorced. But it's how she so much supported the change in my life. But I never thought I'd wind up living in that community and working on the south side at a halfway house for black men on top of it. Yeah. Amen.
Yeah. Right.
Amen.
On. All right, Cuzzo. As always, man, it's good to hear you. Always appreciate
it. Yeah, it's a pleasure.
Support.
I always enjoy listening to you guys.
Right on.
Thank you for saying that, man. You always say it, and it's really it makes me smile every time you say it, man. And I'm so glad nobody can see me, so you don't know I am.
I know where he's going with that.
I know.
Feeling,
yeah, no, all right, my Mondays and Wednesdays revolve around 8 o'clock.
Yeah.
So,
okay.
No, I appreciate you guys and what you do, so thank you.
Amen, man. Amen. Thank you for being, you know, a part of it, man, in so many ways. All right, we're going to spend the next 15 minutes saying thank you.
No, thank you.
All right. So, yeah.
All right.
So, ladies and gentlemen, there you have the great
perspective.
Again, Mondays and Wednesdays, we are live on blogtalkradio.com/thegreatnowseffect. And again, the shows are again saved and archived on your favorite listening platform. I found this little soundbite the other day, since we got Adam on here too, and it's Wednesday. I was just feeling you guys, just thought I'd share real quick.
Uh-oh, guess what day it is? Guess what day it is? Huh?
Bye.
Anybody?
Bye.
Julie, hey, guess what day it is? Oh, come on, I know you can hear me. Mike. What day is it, Mike? Listen, guess what today is?
It's hump day.
Woo-hoo! So I didn't think that was fitting at the beginning. because it's kind of hard to come with that. And then, Lord, it's so hard. So, you know, we're going to come through that. I want to apologize for earlier. I thought my mic was muted. I apologize for clearing my throat inside you all's ears. Sorry about that.
Come on, man.
So,
okay.
You know, that's what it is. Hey. All right. So, ladies and gentlemen, this is the Greenhouse Effect Radio Show, where we provide an opportunity to exercise critical thinking, experience a renewed self-awareness, excuse me, and maybe even a deeper connection to others and their experience, especially when we share interpretations and feelings. So I'm Will, that's Bill over there, and Adam too. until Monday, our live show, you could be any place else listening to the show, but you took time to hear us, so thank you. As always, be
Amen.
Safe, be blessed, be yourself. Have a good night. Amen. Love you, Dad. I'll let you later.
Love you, Will. Love you, Adam. Amen.
Love you guys, too.
What day it is, huh? Anybody? Julie, hey, guess what day it is? Oh, come on, I know you can hear me. Mike. What day is it, Mike? Leslie, guess what today is?
It's hump day.
Woo-hoo!